Isn't this fascinating, if you don't work in this world, to think about this, the coordination problems and the billing problems, the people problems? I think you could read a million articles and not get everything that you've gotten from listening to these two sets of groups of organizations transform what they do and how they do it. I just think this is a wonderful opportunity. I just want to say thank you to both groups of presenters for being so willing to talk about the nitty-gritty and share their experiences with us. I'm so glad that these presentations are being recorded, and people are Twittering about them and talking about them, so they can't hear you, but they can go. People outside the walls are actually accessing our presentations as we're talking. So it'll be fun, I think, for you later to read what they're saying. But what I want to do right now is to, I'd like to welcome you to the presentation entitled Health Screening Dialogues and Comorbid Medical Conditions Among Participants at Community Health Screenings in 4 States. And it's my pleasure to introduce our presenters, Peggy Swarbrick and Lisa Rosano. Dr. Swarbrick is an associate professor in the Department of Psychiatric Rehabilitation and Counseling Professions at Rutgers University, and she directs the collaborative support programs of New Jersey's Wellness Institute. She received her PhD in occupational therapy from New York University, and she's involved in research, training, and consultation activities in the area of wellness and health promotion, employment services, the role of peer support workers, and strategies for enhancing recovery through participation in valued occupations. Dr. Rosano is an associate professor of psychiatry in the University of Illinois at Chicago's Department of Psychiatry and co-principal investigator of the National Research and Training Center on Psychiatric Disability and Co-occurring Medical Conditions. She received her PhD in social psychology from DePaul University. Her research interests include the study of mental and physical health comorbidities, health and mental health outcomes of people living with HIV/AIDS, and the role of health in employment and career development. Please join me in welcoming our presenters.
Thanks very much for the opportunity to present with here today, and this is just a topic that's really near and dear to my heart, and I'm really just excited to be here. I'm going to be here with Lisa, and I'm going to talk a little bit about the health screenings that we conducted, and I'll talk more about the structure and the process of them and some of the dialogues, and Lisa's going to really talk about some of the real data that we found, but really just to understand really some on-the-ground work that I think kind of really fits nicely to what we've, this dialogue today. Want to give the acknowledgments to our funders and again, and as well as really want to make the acknowledgement to our research team, because the people that are listed here, as well as many more of the volunteers, vendors, and the 457 participants that we'll talk about, that we dialogued and we collected data on, really couldn't have done it, and it was just an amazing research team. Many people here today, want to thank everybody. When I want to think about, before we start the dialogue, I'm going to go a little off my script, is that we're talking about health and wellness. And I think what we're going to hear talk about is this health screening that we did to kind of help people think about wellness. And I think defining terms is really important. And if anything, I want to say is that health is some of the indicators that we captured, but wellness is another thing that we want to think about, the definition being physical wellness, but there's spiritual, social, occupational, intellectual, environmental, physical. There's the whole context, and we heard Jonath talk about the social determinants. So we have to keep remembering not to use too much of wellness. We told people not to eat this or that or the other thing, but that's physical area where wellness is just the overall area of our life. So it's just my tangent for the day, and I probably bring it on along another time. And I'm so happy about it that I wear the shirt that I hope that everybody knows about, is the wellness wheel, physical, spiritual, occupational, you know, all over wellness. So we're going to talk about this health fair, and it was really around health and wellness. We got the data you've heard about, and so in New Jersey, at Collaborative Support Programs of New Jersey, we've been involved with trying to bring about recovery, but starting to look at wellness, the whole areas. Physical wellness was important, but in context, housing, employment, spirituality, all the other areas. And we started doing these health screenings in 2009, and want to thank Risa Fox, who's here, who also helped us really get this going around the country. We did it in New Jersey at some peer programs, getting people to go to a fair, get screened to learn about the information so they can bring it to their doctor or they can follow through in their life. And so we started to do these screenings, and then with Risa's support, we did that at the Alternatives Conference, and we were just amazed at the turnout. Now, I'm the skeptic. When we first started this, I didn't think people would come and get on a scale, have their finger pricked. I wasn't too sure about this, but people came, they got it done, and we're gonna hear more, and started to become empowered with the tools and knowledge to help make a change. So from that, we did that in work now in partnership with UIC, Collaborative Support Programs, and many partners in these four states that really helped us organize the fair and the screenings to be able to be part of the NITER grant that was secured to be able to help this make possible. And we said, let's do a screening in these states to collect data, get information, but then help this information to see how people could use this in their life. This was one of the things that we did initially. It's a health passport. We collected health data to help people on their journey to wellness. And so what we did was we organized these health fairs and health to collect this, to do these screenings. And basically this was a document that pulled together the information that people could give. Because we didn't want to just start collecting information from people and then they leave, they do this the survey. They could have something that they could walk home, give to the staff member, give to their family member, give to their loved one, or just themselves could take that information and use that information. And this was one of the tools we used to collect the data and give people. And so we had these screenings set up, and we organized them in the four states. And this was the first station that people would go through a protocol of we went through informed consent, information. People would come to the first station, which was their body mass index. And this is one where I said, who the heck is going to get on a scale and have somebody put them against the wall and, oh, you're obese or you're morbidly obese or, wow. But, this was a thing we did with people, and this was something that was very emotional. This station was very emotional. And I want to say, as we organized these fairs, it was a collaboration, and we had peers in many providers that were there who were really sensitive to those issues of understanding, okay, here's what my BMI is, and this is what it means, and what are you going to do? That part of the dialogue happened, and there was a lot of desires to want to do something, but many people were really, really dealing with struggles. They were struggled with their diet, their exercise, managing their A1Cs, all those kinds of things. But they also were skeptical that they could do something that would make a difference. So there was a dialogue that would happen at these, where we collect the data. Lisa's going to give you that stuff, but the dialogues is what I'm talking about. The desires and struggles were one of the things. So the body mass index was one station. The next stations went around. We had the greatest thing about this was we had peers who were nurses who we could join us. And this is our nurse Betty, who was at many of the fairs, who was just, this is her passion. And actually, we just went up in Harlem a couple weeks ago. We go and do these, and she just loves doing this. But what she would find, you have to have a finger prick, then what does this mean? Your A1C is this level, to have a dialogue with people. And this was people started to become aware, or they were to share some awareness or a lack of awareness of some of the personal risk factors that related to that number. And that was some of the dialogue that occurred there. Many people said that the number they were given in the dialogue was a wake-up call to them. And people really had that, was a great opportunity for them to start to have a conversation, and then hopefully, we're hoping many of them followed through. But they got that information and they were able to talk to someone who could actually say, you know, yeah, I'm a peer too, and I struggle with diabetes and I struggle with these things. The next station as well was related station was to get cholesterol levels, and that was this another theme in that station too, is the numbers that people got was a way they became started more aware of the risk, the awareness of the risk, and started to think about what they could do. The next another station that was a big one was blood pressure, just getting people to know your blood pressure. I just recently even went to my doctor and said, you know, they don't tell you, what is that number? What does it mean? What does it mean in context? That's what the little book that we had, that hopefully you'll get a copy of it. It shows people what it means in health literacy terms, in boiled down language that people understand. And then here there's a dialogue that goes on. And people started to hear more about the lifestyle habits that they could manage. Many people were on, not aware that they could do something in their lifestyle to make that change. Well, I just have to take my medication's not working. But it's other things you can do in your lifestyle that could really help prevent the further damage. That was a big thing. Okay, I have this, but what do I do to prevent this further damage? And this is where some of the dialogue that went on there. In terms of substance abuse and alcohol screening, that was another one that was really, even when we put this together, because our initial screening was just A1C, blood pressure, the body mass index, and that was about what we did. And then we had a lot of wellness resources for people. This screening, we did a dialogue around what is your use, you know, questions that are very, very sensitive to people. But one of the things that we found out in those dialogues, the honesty that people had, the honesty around reporting that people were drinking moderately. People are pretty fed up with the messed up things that are happening in their life. And if I drank, that's what I would be doing if I was in their situation. You know, that's some of the things that we heard were a lot of honesty about use of marijuana, use of cocaine, as well as one man even thanked us for not lecturing him when he was talking about these things, and he also said he was glad we didn't make him feel bad about it, the dialogue talking about it. So there was these really honest dialogues that we heard. And of course, you see the pictures, many people here in the room. Even more, we saw, smoking risks. That was another one. As we know, the smoking rates are so high. People started really talking about the benefits of quitting smoking and getting feedback and support from other peers who are former smokers or current smokers on what their strategies are and what they can do to really think about what they can do to cut down and or quit, a harm reduction approach. A big one was the heart attack risk assessment. This one was a real favorite station. You could see we got some favorite people here in the station and there. But it was a favorite station, right? Because people got to now get information that we're gathering already from them that could help them to see that their heart attack risk. So we weren't just gathering this information and then putting it in and they never see it till the journal comes out 3 or 5 years later. It came out to them right there, what is their risk factor for potentially a heart attack risk? And what could you do, perhaps, if you made a little change that could lower or that risk? So people started to really get empowered, and they were so surprised and very intrigued by this station and this station that they were at. And I think that was a really important one to have that as part of the screening, to give people that immediate feedback and then start to show them the health risks. So then one of the final stations that came about, and I have a couple, explain both of these pictures a little bit, was the peer support. That was central to all of this, is having a peer supporter there at the station or at the end to help really process the information that they got, that they received, and the reactions. I mean, we had people, you know, there's emotional crying and a lot of things happening, and they could talk to someone, a peer, who had that experience and could really listen to them, talk to them, provide some resources. Many also were really unaware of what risks that they had. That was a major theme that we saw, unaware that they were in the diabetes or pre-diabetes range. They had a range of beliefs about their health, and you know, people just were misinformed about a lot of things about what they were. You know, I'm just you drinking all these smoothies all day. That's supposed to help me, not realizing that you know you want to have more of a balanced diet. Surprised when they were in the high risk range, and really unaware of things like sleep and rest and other small things that they could do in their lifestyle habits that could really help them make, you know, would make an impact on the numbers that they had or help them to gain that control, because people feel really out of control. So they got that peer support. They were also very surprised at the simplicity of a lot of the tests, things that they could do at their home or they could do, and it also helped to sensitize people to maybe go to those doctor's appointments or follow through with some of those appointments. Many people were like, I'm gonna take this to my doctor, you know, or I'm gonna bring this to my ACT team or, you know, whoever they were working with. The other thing I wanna talk about with the peer support as part of this health screening model was that this is the folks from Threshold. They were so central to the whole modeling of doing this, is they were volunteering to help guide people around or be there to maybe talk to people. And so that was another element of this screening that we did. We had a lot of peer supporters in the local states really helped us to put together the screenings, run the screenings, and really just a great resource, I believe. More than likely they are following through with the things that we had shared, with the experiences. So really, the what I wanted to convey is this structure for the health screening that we did and how we had these dialogues and how we structured it with peer support as a central piece to really make this work in a collaboration. And wanted just to say that I think that it's really important that you don't think that you have to have a lot of money from NIDA or SAMHSA to do this. These screenings could happen in a small room in an agency. We created a book, a manual now that's available that shows people from soup to nuts what you can do to plan it for a 10-person screening or a 200 or 300-person screening. There's a whole soup to nut way you can plan these. And what I do a lot is I started this like in the, it was the tiny one peanut in the jar because it was just with no money at all. We did this in a peer center, with just getting a few A1C kits to get a volunteer of a nurse peer and to get some blood pressure cuffs. So you can do this in your agencies or you can do this out in the community and particularly start to partner with the local communities. It's a great way for agencies and to encourage them to do this and or on large scales. So I'm gonna turn it over to Lisa and then I'm gonna, we'll take questions.
So thank you. To talk a little bit about the program results has been very exciting for us at the center, to not only site by site as we would go forward, but then we would come home and we would start to combine data, and we would not only find some nuance from all of the sites that we went to individually, but then we started to definitely find some patterns that we thought were, you know, again, it was great, it's great data to find, but it has some very alarming and important results. So I think that's the research friend or foe dualism, that we find out things that can sometimes we have to process. So to just talk about the health fair attendees a little bit, we had, as Peggy said, 450 individuals in recovery at four collaborating sites. The programs in New Jersey, our colleagues here at Thresholds. We also worked with two programs in Maryland, Waystation and St. Luke's, who focused on people who were in their vocational programs at those sites. And then we worked at a Highland Rivers site in Georgia. And I know Sherry is over there, and you are a huge supporter in helping us build relationships with that site and to come to Georgia, so we thank you. I can tell you, in talking about the data, there are relatively few differences between the site samples, and when there were differences, which are, I think, maybe two or three cases, they're very minimal, and we've controlled for them in the analyses that I want to talk about this morning. So in our sample, I think it well represents individuals for the most part. Now, this is the combined sample of 457 people, predominantly male, but pretty much 50-50 there. Most of the people in the study are either white or African American. We did have a slightly higher number of Latinos in one site versus another. But for the most part, you'll see, obviously, mostly white and African American. High school education, about what we often see with people, the majority of people have high school education or less. About 31% were participating in work. I mention that because some of you might be thinking about that rate of employment among individuals, and again, the Maryland site was specifically helping us recruit people in VOC programs, so that may seem a little higher because we had that VOC program representation there. Most of the people were supported by public insurance and entitlements, and I can tell you in Georgia we had a lot of individuals who actually, the site with the highest amount of people who reported no form of insurance, public or otherwise. 89% of the individuals reported using some form of medication management for their mental health symptoms, different classes. So one of the first things we asked about in the pretest, as Peggy alluded to, we did an informed consent process, and then people went into a pretest interview, and most of the interviewers are here, and I just want to publicly thank you for all the work you did, Marie, Pam, all of you. You can see here we used questions from the NHANES, a large national health and nutrition examination survey. We then really picked in concert with what we saw, because the NHANES uses, I believe, 32 different health conditions. So we felt that that was getting a little lengthy. So we went back to the NASHBID report and we mapped our choice of NHANES questions to the types of things where you're typically going to see the health disparities and the places where NASHBID had already reported some health disparities to ensure that we address those items. So you can see here on the left the list of the things that we asked. And then you can see self-reported. And basically the question is, has a physician or any other medical professional ever told you you're diagnosed with asthma? Then the individual would answer yes or no. And from there, we would ask a series of follow-up questions. Are you currently in treatment? Are you using medication? Are you having symptoms? Different things from there. In the sample prevalence, you can see in the middle column what we found for different illnesses. And then in the national prevalence is what you can see on the far right. And those are things taken primarily from epidemiological studies, from CDC reporting, and the same benchmarks that you might use in national, really, health surveillance databases. You also can see that we had pretty much across the board significant differences between the level of self-reported health condition compared to the rate of what you saw in the NHANES for the population in general to report that same health condition. I will note here at the bottom that with a few things we did not report in this table, arthritis, tuberculosis, and HIV, because I'm very pleased to report that the number of individuals who self-reported HIV or TB was so small that we couldn't really even statistically examine that. So I attribute that to the great work of Thresholds and Chicago House and all the people locally and in the world who address HIV prevention, which all of you know is a big health interest of mine. So having said that, you know, some of the things, I think the ones that don't surprise us probably are what we see in diabetes, where 21% of people reported that they had been told they had diabetes compared to maybe only about 8% in the general population. Hypertension, 44% compared to about 26, and then the hyperlipidemia. And I'll mention, circle back to those again in a second. The other one that I thought was really interesting is we talk a lot about lung cancer and some of the consequences like COPD. I think emphysema comes in that category, but as many agencies are seeing their members age, I think in addition to just seeing the aging effects of illness, we're seeing the long-term effects of these health behaviors, and emphysema obviously being one of those from long-term smoking and chronic lung diseases. It's not moving, okay. Then we went in and we actually screened people, as Peggy described. And so the health passport that we put up and you can download for free on our center was a tool, as we said, that people used in the health screening because we really wanted them to not only get feedback about how their health was, depending, you know, if you had said in the NHANES that, yes, I was a person with diabetes, it was still worth us asking you to do an A1C test because that's really an issue about how well are you managing your diabetes. And as Peggy said, regardless of any past experience or diagnosis, it was an opportunity to open up a dialogue with you about how you manage your diabetes and some of the steps that you might take. In addition to the passport, you can also download some fact sheets that were developed at the center where they're written at a sixth grade, I believe, or eighth grade level. Every person, regardless of their screening outcome, was given the fact sheet, which basically described these are facts about risks of diabetes or heart disease or hypertension, and on the back side, it would give you a list of things that you could do to reduce your risks or ways that you could promote health and wellness in those areas. So the tools really worked in tandem. It was the booklet that gave you your own values, and then in addition to that, we had the fact sheets to kind of give people some tools in some specific areas. So you can see here in obesity, we used the CDC criteria for body mass index. 82% of the individuals in our sample screened to be at risk for obesity, 30 above, 60% would be considered morbidly obese. You can see the differences there in the general population. Again, these are coming from bigger epidemiological studies. With hyperlipidemia, about 7% of individuals screened as being in the high cholesterol, and about 13% of the population. And so I think, learned in the health screening, we were like, well, that's really interesting. We would have expected to see more high cholesterol. What we actually found out when we circled back to those NHANES questions was a lot of these people were, in fact, already diagnosed and using some kind of medication treatment, like a statin or Lipitor, no drug affiliation, just saying, where they were in treatment. And so what we found was we were probably detecting more of a management thing in terms of how well people were doing, because so many people said they were hypertensive and were actually using chemical or pharmacological intervention. With diabetes, we used the A1C, and one of the reasons we chose that at the health fair is because you don't have to fast for an A1C, you don't have to have phlebotomy for an A1C. I don't know about you, but I'd rather you stuck my finger than my vein on any given day. And the other reason, I think, is the A1C is more of a management test than a diagnostic test. It's telling you how well you're managing around a 2 to 3 month period. And so it's a little harder to game that than, you know, you're eating really badly for 2 weeks, you know your health screening's coming up, and so 3 days you're really on the wagon of healthy eating. And so you can move a glucose test around a little bit. And so I think this was not only more procedurally appropriate, but it was giving us more of a sense, again, of management of health. We found 14% were at the 6.5 or higher, which is the beginning of pre-diabetes and into diabetes. I can tell you that we had a couple of individuals throughout the whole study that we did. I think we only had to do some kind of crisis management maybe 3 times over 457 people. One of the individuals that we had to call and follow up with medical service was a gentleman who came in, and I believe his A1C was 14. And so, you know, again, we had worked with the nurses on Peggy's team and other health care providers to tell us, you know, if we screen someone who's in a very dangerous level, what are we going to do about that? Because we might not just want them to leave the health fair. So that was an individual where, again, he got some counseling, he got some intervention, and people were able to tell him a little more about his diabetes management. You can see there, again, large discrepancies between the samples we screened at risk based on A1C and what you see in the general population. Same thing for hypertension, slightly higher, like high cholesterol, but perhaps not to the same extent. We detected a lot of individuals who had already been identified as having hypertension and were using some kind of medication intervention to manage their hypertension. We saw a lot of smokers, and in addition to just asking people, do you smoke, yes or no, we asked people about the amount of tobacco they're actually using, and that was something that was a really interesting dialogue with a lot of people, because there were a few people that if we had just asked, do you smoke, they'd have said yes. And it turned out that they had evolved to a point where they were smoking 2 cigarettes a day. They had one in the morning, then they had one in the afternoon. And so it was great to tease out the differences between all smokers, because we did have people who were smoking maybe a pack a day or even a pack and a half a day. And so that use of nicotine, you know, again, to open up a dialogue with them at the peer station would be slightly different than what you might talk about to someone who's really reduced their smoking. With Audit C and the DAST, we saw, you know, again, that sort of 2-to-1 substance use risk that we often document between the general population and individuals in recovery. And then we got to, as we said, the Framingham heart disease risk. And I think one of the reasons we selected that was for a number of reasons. One is they had been to stations throughout the health fair that had provided them and us with the data on the health passport that you actually use in a computer application for the Framingham Health Study. MedCalc has come up with a program that you can go into, and you put in the person's age, and you put in the person's gender, and based on their cohort, it gives you the probability that they might have a heart attack in the next 5 years. So having put in their age and their gender, we could then put in the information that we would use. So cholesterol was one, whether an individual was living with diabetes was another, whether the person was a smoker, and those multivariable tools gave us the opportunity to look at what their smoking risk was compared to their own cohort. One of the reasons we also liked this tool so much was because with the dialogue part of the study, you know, if a person was a smoker, and let's say, I'll just say mine, 51-year-old woman, all my health risks, whatever, I'm about my cohort, 5% heart risk in the next 10 years. Well, if I was a smoker or I was diabetic, my heart attack risk actually goes up to 11%. So if you unclicked the electronic box for smoking, you would actually see your cardiac risk go down to more commensurate with your cohort risk. That was a way to open that dialogue and say, you know, quitting smoking is a great goal. Reducing your smoking, even on the way to quitting smoking, is going to improve your cardiac health. Managing your hypertension, if someone was hypertensive and we changed their values to a more normative hypertension value, this is why it's so important for you to monitor your hypertension, because your heart attack risk reduces. And it was very concrete and very visual for people, and they really, really enjoyed, I think, the health app a lot. It was a fun station, and I think it was a great way to open up those conversations for when people circled back around to Peggy. But you'll also see nearly three times the risk for cardiac, over 20% risk compared to the general population. This is also a nice application to use, not only because of the gendered effect, but also the age effect, because all coronary illnesses being healthy or not, diseases of aging, and our populations are aging. So we then asked about people's health attitudes, and one of the things that I think was really compelling to all of us is we use some pretty traditional kinds of health information scales. The self-rated abilities for health practices, which ask questions about people being able to monitor their own health and manage their own health, their competence for health maintenance, and then we did use the traditional multidimensional health locus of control from that initial kind of research that they did in public health, and with internal control, powerful others, and the chance. We used random regression, controlling for sex, age, race, education, and study site. And this is what we found. And I think one of the things most compelling about this is that people were probably at the health fair itself in the stations for probably 90 minutes, maybe 2 hours, depending on how long their pre-test interview was and their post-test interview was. And what I think is so interesting is even in 60 to 90 minutes, by having fairly simple screening, personalized to your needs, and then have somebody who's an individual in recovery, your peer, who's competent, and talks with you in an affirming and strength-based way. And I think, you know, Peggy's saying, you know, when somebody told us about a lot of substance use, that was not our opportunity to yell at them, because they would just be like, all right, I'm done with you. So it was really a way to be really open about the health promotion and think about things that people could do. What we see here are pretty much significant outcomes in terms of attitudinal change just from the 60 to 90 minutes that they participated in the health fair. And so I think it's a way for us to connect with people, again, in a very strength-based psychiatric rehabilitative environment, to say, you can stall your health risks at any time. We may not be able to undo some of the health risks that you're living with, but you can certainly stop them and give people capacity to move forward in much more health and wellness promoting ways. And so at least these results would suggest that in many of these areas of health maintenance and ability, we can affect some positive change with things like health fairs, and by using peers as part of that dialogue, either from their own personal experience or the fact that they're really connecting with people in terms of wellness. We are trying to get out in front of a lot of these data, and so we have several papers that are going to be coming out with this. One of them reports the discrepancies between our screen data and general population results, as well as those attitudinal change, and that's this physical health screening paper that will be coming out. Peggy and her team worked on a health dialogue screening paper that's going to be coming out, and now we're looking at some comorbidities of individuals who have treatment and those who don't. And one of the things that's interesting about that is we did look at four different illnesses where the disparities were wider than 10%. And so that was hypertension, diabetes, asthma, and two others, and looking at those. I'm also very happy to report that we've dug back into the data, and we're working on papers related to obesity and gender, which have been very compelling, as well as the crosswalk and interaction between individuals who are living with diabetes and whether or not they're experiencing obesity or morbid obesity. And so we've been very excited and happy about that. So Any questions? And yes.